Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski. This is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is room tuning expert Bob Hodes. But first, I want to talk about Vivo and Warner Music. Those of you who don't know what Vivo is, it's a music video service that's owned primarily by Sony and Universal, two of the three major labels, and also partially owned by Google and the Abu Dhabi Media Group. Most of the time, you see Vivo videos on YouTube. So if you're looking at a major label artist that's either on Sony or Universal, chances are the videos that you see will have a Vivo logo on it. But Vivo is also a standalone music service that you can access through Vivo.com. Now, if you take notice, there's only two of the major labels and not all three. And that's where this begins to get interesting. Because Vivo is now in talks with Warner Music, the third major label, to actually come into the fold. And it's interesting because Warner basically doesn't want to do it because they can't see much of an upside. Now, what the upside could possibly be if all three major labels control their music videos, they can actually push a better deal, or they think they might be able to push a better deal with YouTube for more of the ad revenue, which may or may not benefit artists because you never know how that'll go and how much will actually trickle down. As of now, Warner Music is very happy just being on YouTube and is listening to the proposal from the other two major labels with an open mind, as I understand it, but there's no guarantee that they're actually going to buy in. Is this going to help the music business in general? Is this going to help you as an artist? Is this going to help you as a songwriter? Well, maybe, maybe not. If all three major labels are involved in something, yes, it's entirely possible that they can get a better deal. On the other hand, if they pull all their videos back from YouTube and they just keep it on their own Vivo.com, that would actually be a lot better for independent artists, for artists with indie labels, because people won't be able to find the videos. And you know what? They're used to going to YouTube and they're not used to going to Vivo.com. So maybe Warner's is actually helping everybody by not buying in, but we'll see what the future brings. So just watch this. And next time you're watching a music video on YouTube, just check out to see if there's a Vivo logo on it. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. It's all one word, musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. Now let's talk about self-production. Just about everybody has their own home studio these days, which means, at least to some degree, you're self-producing. That could be good or bad, depending how you look at it. What I've found is that one of two things happens when you're self-producing. Either you're doing it too fast or you're doing it too slow. What do I mean? Generally speaking, if you're doing it too fast, it means that you're actually not taking enough time and enough care in the production. This usually happens from artists who aren't really studio wise, who haven't been in with a major producer making a record before. And you find that they take a whole lot less time because they really don't know that you have to get it a lot tighter and a lot better than they normally would. The thing about music production is it really takes a lot of work. Everybody who's done it, especially if you're doing a record for the first time, you're always amazed at how much more time it takes to really get a part down. It's not easy. It's very humbling as well because you find out just how good or just how bad you are when it really comes down to it. One of the other things that happens when someone tries to self-produce for the first time is it can be very discouraging because you don't sound as good as you think, especially the first time. You put a part down and it doesn't sound perfect and you expect it to. And what will happen a lot of times is that an artist will really get discouraged. But just remember, unless you're one of the chosen few, this is what happens to everybody. Everybody needs to take a lot of time, needs that extra time, when they're actually putting a part down. Now, the opposite of going too fast is going too slow, and this happens an awful lot where people try to get it too perfect. And what will happen is they'll be working on the same song or the same album for years, and it's never quite good enough. This is really a bad thing, and it's especially bad in the music 4.0 age that we live in, because that's not the way it works. So there are two remedies to that. The first is to remember that usually your first instinct is the best. And I've been around people, and I'm sure many of you listening have been around people that have so many ideas and they want to try them all. I can remember one artist I was working with in particular. We'd finish a song and he'd say, I'd like to try it reggae. And we finished that and he'd say, well, I'd like to try it as a ballad. And we'd finish it that way and he'd say, well, I want to give it a New Orleans feel. And we'd do five or six different versions and always come back to the first one. It was just making it different and not necessarily better. So just remember that usually your first instinct is the best one. The second thing is always set yourself a deadline, because that deadline will make sure that you actually finish a project. Usually what ends up happening is if you don't have that deadline, it will go on forever. The way things are today in our music 4.0 world, singles matter, albums don't. So really what you'd want to do is finish a song, get it out the door. Finish a song, get it out the door. Finish another one, get it out the door. And when you have enough, put them all together into an album. In the meantime, that's giving you exposure. There are different events to promote. And this is the way it's done these days. To wait until you have a full album before you do any releases really takes the wind out of your sails in terms of promotion and in terms of your fans getting bored and just going off to someplace else and not being used to hearing music from you all the time. So it's really important that you always release new music and you do it as quickly as possible, which means you should set deadlines for yourself. You should make things as good as you can, understanding hardly anything is perfect. You're probably not Steely Dan and nobody else is. So just try to make it as good as you can under the circumstances. But it's better to have something that's not perfect and have it out than to have something that's perfect and have it 3 years too late. My guest today is Bob Hodes, who's tuned more than 1,000 rooms during his years in the business. Bob has tuned all sorts of rooms, from large commercial studios like the Record Plant, to small home studios, to remote trucks, to home theaters. And he's going to give us some insight into the room tuning process. I spoke with Bob via Skype from his studio in San Francisco. How did you get started tuning rooms? That's a very unique profession. And only a few people have managed to do it. So how did it happen to you?
Well, it was self-defense, really. At the time, I was a recording engineer, and I was traveling around to a number of different studios around, between the U.S. and Japan. And I found that in some rooms, I would make a good record, and in some rooms, I wouldn't make such a good record. You know, that when I got outside, the results were disappointing. And so I, from my live sound experience and my home studio experience, before I, quote, hit the big time, I had a garage studio in Colorado. And I had learned something about room tuning. And so I started just doing it, going into the room and taking a day before. And one of the big things that I did was to I had a pair of phase poppers from the live sound days, polarity testers, basically. And I would pop everything out in the studio, because in those days, there was no polarity standard. So there was, the European mics were pin 2 and the American mics were pin 3. And people weren't paying attention to polarity in those days. And aside from the fact that, the consoles were, I think the consoles worldwide were maybe pin 3, but the tape machines were all pin 2. I mean, it was pretty nutty, Yeah. I don't know if you remember in the good old days, when they finally made the standard, one year at the AES, somebody made the polarity spinner. So it was just this little, do you remember that?
I do remember it, yes.
Yeah. And you just, spin it and it's like, okay, you get whatever polarity, you know, it came up on the spinner. That was kind of the deal. So I would go in and I would just phase correct or polarity correct everything in the studio. That was the very beginning, just, you know, to get that straightened out, because people weren't doing that, you know. And I had a console full of, I'd go pop every mic after the setup, and there was a console full of a variety of polarity switches in and out. And it helped me make better recordings. And that led to doing more work on the speaker systems themselves to kind of try to shape and tune them so that some of my reference material made sense to me in the studio. So I did it really just for myself for quite a while. Paul Stubblebein, I had worked in Paul's studios, and Paul knew about me doing this stuff. And one day, Sandy Perlman needed his room tuned, and Paul suggested he get me to go in there, because at that point I was, you know, I'd figured out first order reflections and things, and I was, you know, I could even put up some absorbers and, you know, on a crude level. So Paul suggested that Sandy get me into his room to tune it, and that was like my first paying job, and that was, I don't know, that must have been 1990 or something like that. And I didn't really pursue it. Once again, I just did it because I was asked. And when John Meyer developed the SIM system, the Source Independent Measurement System, for designing speakers, and then realized that they could use that for tuning, you know, PA systems, in the early days, I would go out on jobs with John when he was sort of developing the concept and see how that all got put together. And when they finally made a product that could be sold, I bought one right away, just thinking, you know, once again, it was self-defense, but it grew into sort of, you know, doing more work, you know, it really started to get known that I was doing this, you know, because I would bring this stuff into the studio. I mean, it was at that point, it was professional, I guess, you know. So,
well, you had a professional tool that nobody else had, right?
Yes. And it was much higher resolution than what everybody else was using. I mean, most people were using third octave, and or they were maybe using another variety that was, 12th octave or something, but wouldn't work in real time. So SIM allowed me to look at phase and frequency and coherence all in real time at 24th octave resolution. The new machine that I have is 48th octave resolution. You know, very fast, very efficient. And, I mean, I learned so much from that, having that tool, making that investment, that I just kind of like gathered, you know, so much more knowledge. It was kind of amazing. And then the funny part of the story, or not so funny, is in 1993, I did a project for an artist. I was mixing a CD that, you know, or, you know, project she recorded. And I'd done several CDs with her before. She, this time, she was so neurotic. I mean, it was such a crazy session that I really got, you know, like clinically depressed about going into the studio, showing up to mix this thing. I mean, it was so, she was like nutcasing off on like every meter in the place. I don't know what happened, but she had, in, you know, since I had done her last project, she'd worked with some other people and they'd explain things like, well, you know, the compressor needle shouldn't really move, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, rules of thumb, and I'm not a believer in rules of thumb at all. So, you know, you just make it sound the way you want it to sound in the studio. That's my attitude. And so, you know, and she was like freaking out on the meters, and she was freaking out on the, the moving faders not coming back exactly to our marks, you know. And I'm going, can you hear a difference? Do you hear, is there a problem with what you're hearing? No. Well, then let's not worry about this thing visually, but, you know, everything was an issue. I taped over every meter in the studio except for the two-track meter, you know, the tape machine. So at the end of that session, when I got done with getting that record out, I said, I'm going to take 6 months off. I'm going to let people know that I'm available to tune rooms, and I'm just going to get my energy back and get my attitude back, and then I can go back to recording and mixing, and you know, and I'll still do the room tuning on the sideline. Well, in that 6 months, the room tuning just exploded for me, and so I never went back. I haven't done a session since 1993, you know, so I guess I should be thanking this artist for launching a new career. But I have to say, it's, I'm helping more people make better records. It's very satisfying. And it's a job that needs to be done. You know, not enough people do it, that's for sure.
When you go in, well, first of all, how long did it take you before you felt really good about what you're doing? Because I know that there's so much that has to do with taste as well as the scientific part as well. And you can look at things and say, this looks right, but it doesn't sound right to me.
Yes. Well, that's a really great point. And I think the fact that I had been a musician and a sound engineer, you know, recording, mixing engineer, that's what gave me an edge, you know, over guys that just, let's say, design rooms and then go out and tune them. And also, you know, I've got a history of sort of an audiophile slant to my career as well. So I wrote, you know, tons of reviews for Recording Engineer, Producer, and Mix Magazine. You know, I've been a deep listener for a long time. That's really, you know, I think, essential. And because, yes, you can make a flat line on a graph, and that doesn't mean it's a musical system, or that it's even going to help the engineer make the record sound the way he wants it to sound. Because each artist is different. You know, I've got, for example, over at Larrabee, when I started working at Larrabee, Dave Pensado was working there, Manny Mariquin, and Jason Joshua. All, you know, big hit mixer guys. And they all had different tastes. And so the concept was to develop a curve for each of them individually that would help them make the record that they wanted to make. And so you have to be flexible. There isn't just one way to do anything. And as I said earlier, you know, I'm not a rule of thumb guy. You know, the laws of physics I believe in, but other than that, you know, I'm not afraid to do something stupid or crazy when I get into a room, especially when it comes to like setting up subwoofers. You just have to do what the speaker wants you to do in the room, you know, in order to get the result. And of course, there are things that you don't want to do, which would try to make the speaker perform in a way that would be very nonlinear or lose headroom, things like that, like doing boosting, you know, ridiculous amounts of boosting or something like that, or at certain frequencies that would, let's say, make the speaker be nonlinear, or try to compensate for a real problem in the room that should be compensated for acoustically as opposed to through equalization. It's great if I can use just acoustics to fix something, but most studios have equalizers and I end up, you know, doing work on the equalizers. It's kind of a combo effort. you know, but well, it's, but yeah, the musical part of it, yeah, you can't just set up a computer and make a flat line and expect it to be good, you know.
Well, does that mean that you have a curve that you aim for different types of music? So in other words, if you know this person is doing R&B, then there's one curve, and if you know another one's doing metal, you do another curve. Do you have something like that?
Yes, I do. If I go into a room that I've never been into before, I might call up, you know, as a to get a start, you know, to get a start. I might call up a curve that I did for, you know, I don't know, in one of the Capitol Records rooms, or a curve that I did for Dave Pensado, or, you know, a curve that I did for a broadcast, you know, studio or a mastering studio. And then at least that would give me a start on what I know works for somebody else that may fit into a certain genre. And then we take it from there. But, you know, you have to be flexible. I mean, you know, what works for one guy doesn't always work for the other. And part of my job is to try to not let somebody do something stupid that I think is going to be a mistake. At the other hand, you know, I have to interpret what are the creative needs of the engineer versus, you know, well, versus the ability of the room and the system to support that.
Right.
You know, I mean, these days, a lot of the R&B hip hop guys are, you know, I mean, they're listening louder and louder, and the bass is getting hotter and hotter in these rooms. And if I mixed a record in some of these rooms, or I've had this conversation with Dave Pensado, if, you know, he says the same thing. You know, if he went into, you know, Jason's room and mixed something, he'd come out with no bass because Jason's room has the bass so hot. But it works for Jason, you know. So on one hand, you have to be flexible and attuned to the needs of the client. You know, that's really important. On the other hand, you have to keep them from, let's say, going, wow, this is really fun, I love this, and then they mix the record and they come out, there's no bass on there.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, right.
The bass is so hot in the room and it's moving so much air that they get it out and it's not, you know, it doesn't exist. So we still want the mastering engineer. We want to create a curve that is non-linear, but the engineer doesn't make mistakes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That nothing's really missing or too much, so that when it gets to mastering, the mastering engineer doesn't have to fix things. They only put their creative effort into it. You know, it's another stage of creativity, as you know, as opposed to correcting all the mistakes that were made in the studio.
When you go into a room, and if it doesn't have equalizers already in line, do you tune by changing some of the acoustics, or do you ask them to buy something in order for you to do your job better, or how does that work?
Well, you know, I mean, every situation is different. I just did a room this past week in LA that the guy had somebody design a new space for him. They tore out the old space and put in a new space. And that room didn't really need any equalization. It would be a matter of taste whether he wanted it or not. And we made a decision not to put any EQ on the left and right side and just see how well he learns to live with the room. If you can get away with that, that's really great. And also, you know, I mean, you know, there are rooms that you can do that with that don't, you know, don't need to be equalized. Sometimes I'll go into a scenario where, you know, the bass is really nonlinear from left to right, So the correct answer is add a subwoofer to the system. If I have the flexibility, then I'm going to start out by moving the speakers and the listening position around, because I think most of the problems, let's say 70%, I'm throwing a number out, but 70% of the problem is the actual position of the room and the listener and how the boundary interference patterns work against you or for you. So number one is let's get the speakers and the listener in the very best position they can possibly be. If that's enough, then that's where we stop. But generally, once that happens, then it's a matter of trying to find out how to correct the problems that exist with acoustics only. And you go as far as you can with the acoustics. And then if there are certain things that, let's say, are a matter of taste, then you try to, the last stage would be, equalization. Equalization is the very last thing to try to do. I'd much rather do it acoustically as possible. And also, there's some flexibility. Different systems have, let's say, crossovers that you can adjust. Of course, you've got amplifier levels and crossovers. Some speakers have some, dip switches, for high and low pass, and some even have a couple of parametric filters built into them that you can play with. I'd prefer to go as far as I can before adding an external EQ. But, it's not a perfect world. Most people, for most people, most of the studios require equalization. Lots and lots of major studios are equalizing their rooms. And of course, every film, every dub stage, everybody's conforming to a Dolby standard or DTS or something, So almost everybody in post has EQ, You got to get an X curve on there, or, you've got to make sure that the subwoofer is fairly flat, if there's a big giant peak in the subwoofer, that's going to, and you're just setting, you're setting up your levels to the Dolby standard, a big high Q peak is going to throw off your overall volume adjustments. And the subs need to be, fairly flat in order to get you into the ballpark when you're doing a LFB calibration, for instance.
What do you recommend if you feel that a system needs an external EQ? What do you recommend generally that they would get, the client would get?
Oh, well, I'm a parametric guy. I have tons and tons of people who have had equalizers for years, and they're generally third octave. If I can talk them into switching over to parametric, I will. Otherwise, I tune with what I have. But the reason I like a parametric equalizer is probably the same reason that you want a parametric EQ on your mixing console as opposed to a fixed frequency, fixed Q equalizer. It allows me to actually address the problem as it exists in the room by selecting the exact center frequency of the problem and selecting the exact Q of the problem. So it seems like a no-brainer to me, that a third octave lets you tune around a problem, but a parametric actually lets you go after the problem exactly as it exists without affecting too many other frequencies around it.
How many bands do you need?
Well, it depends. It goes anywhere from two bands. I've used as little as two bands, and I've used 10 bands. So it just depends on the room and the situation and what the client wants. I've got some clients that, would be perfectly happy with having just a couple of points, picked out and bring it into line, and then they adapt to it. And I have other clients that, you know, just want, get very, very, you know, analytical about some small little, you know, half dB or, you know, at some frequency that's kind of going, you know, could you just drop this down a little bit? And that's, you know, that we're talking more about taste, but it makes them comfortable and make good records in the room. So in those cases, I'm using more bands. I mean, generally, my attitude is if I need more than five bands to tune a room, we need to do more work acoustically. But, you know, the trade-off is the fact that, you know, if you need to move a wall or tear out, you know, half the studio, you know, that's maybe the right way to do it, but people can't necessarily afford the time or the money to do that. And if we can, we can do it with EQ, the trade-off is you get something that's corrected and allows you to make a good record, but you wind up with a much smaller sweet spot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so the area that you're confined to for listening accurately becomes much smaller at that point.
What's the EQ that you recommend they get, though, the model?
I have to make a disclaimer here, you know, that I am a dealer for certain, you know, certain products. And also, for a number of years, Meyer Sound has built an equalizer to my specification. And even before they did that, I gravitated towards the Meyer CP10 and CP10S because it's a minimum phase equalizer. I'm very concerned with phase coherence, and and it was developed specifically for room tuning. It's a good solid equalizer, and it sounds better than anything on the market. It's getting harder and harder these days to find analog EQ. Meyer has legacied their analog EQs. A lot of people have. I think my number two choice generally has been the Clark Technic DN410. I think the Meyer's the best sounding out there, but I think, as far as I know, number two would be the Clark Technic. Mm-hmm. I think they still make them. I'm pretty sure they still make those new. But, you know, a lot of people go on eBay and, you know, buy used EQs. Generally, they're not in very good shape. That's been my experience coming off of eBay. They're rarely fit out of the box. You know, they might have dirty pots or switches or something. I generally ask people to send them to me, you know, to get modded. Clark Technic also has their service department. You can send them off to them and they'll fix whatever's wrong. But there's nothing worse than showing up at somebody's studio and you need to do something and you push a band in on, you know, you insert a band on the EQ and it doesn't do anything, or it does, or it goes completely wacko and you really need that to finish completing the room. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, sorry, I have to come back, you know, which is expensive, you know.
How long does it take you to do a room? I'm sure that varies a lot, but is there an average that you kind of expect to spend?
Yeah, I'm going to say 5 to 8 hours, you know, to go through a room completely. Now, that's for a room I've never been into that has freestanding monitors and subwoofers and has the ability to do maybe some acoustical mock-ups. You know, if somebody's got a pre-designed room, they don't want to do any more work on the room itself. Speakers are in the wall and it's, you know, they've got EQ, then it's going to take me less time to do that. My retunes I have a number of clients that, you know, drive their speakers pretty hard and they go through, they recone their woofers every 6 months to a year. And when I show up to retune their room, we're really doing is compensating for having, you know, put new speakers in. You know, sometimes they want to change out, you know, try a new subwoofer or something like that. But generally, that kind of job's a 3-hour job, 4-hour job, because there's a process of tuning, and you always have to listen. I mean, there's no tuning without listening in my book. You know, because, you know, components, you know, the tolerances of manufacturing, let's say, they can change the way something's going to sound. So, but a new room, 5 to 8 hours, just depends on how much freedom I get in making corrections. And, you know, sometimes it's a matter of just identifying what the problems are, and the people are willing to do some kind of construction, or there's just no way out of doing some kind of construction. And so, you know, I'll have to go back and make a second trip, you know, instruct them on what we need to do or what products they need to buy, where to install them. And then I'll come back and do more measurements and, you know, and then take it from there.
Are there typical problems that you run into and they seem to pop up more than others?
I think the biggest problem really, I mean, like I said, is placement, you know, not having the speakers in the right spot. I mean, people just don't realize how important that is. You can't just stick a speaker in the room and equalize it and expect it to, you know, to get the job done for you, you know, because you're asking the equalizer to correct and the speaker to correct for bigger problems in the room than really exist. So, I mean, that's number one. And especially with subwoofer. Subwoofer integration to me is one of those things that's the most difficult. I mean, I've spent hours trying to, you know, in some rooms trying to figure out where the subwoofer goes and what the phase interaction is with the sub and what the orientation of the sub is. It's a complicated formula, and I just don't see how people can do it without some kind of measurement tool. It's just too difficult to do by ear, especially, you know, since a lot of subwoofers now have more sophisticated control of the phase. And there's a play between, you know, pluses and minuses when you start messing with this stuff. Sometimes you get some frequencies in phase, but others are out. You know, you have to make some decision which is going to give you a better performance. It's not always a, you know, a simple line. And even hearing those things is really a difficult way to make a decision. So I want to see a phase plot, and I want to see a, you know, high resolution frequency plot in order to really do the best job that you can. So, yeah, that I think, you know, some problems, you know, you need to add a subwoofer to a room. And a subwoofer can, I used to be a purist and think, no, let's try to do everything in the main speakers. But once I realized that if I could get the phase interaction at the crossover point to be like a zero phase, have you know, zero phase shift at the crossover point, that I could make the sub disappear. You know, I could make it appear, you know, that just really make it disappear. Even if it's stuck over on one side of the room or the other, you know, there are ways to do it. And most of it has to do with phase interaction.
See,
and once I figured that out, you know, I became much more of a fan of subs, because they can really help correct low frequency problems. And face it, most people's room problems are low frequency. Yeah. If correcting high frequency problems is, you know, pretty simple with acoustics. You know, it's kind of like, you know, just simple geometry. But the low frequencies are a whole different animal, and they're going to act differently in each room. It depends on where you've got your equipment set up. You know, outboard equipment, racks. It's all so interactive. I've become a big fan of subs.
I always thought that if whatever your main speakers are, you should probably get a subwoofer by that same manufacturer because they'll match and it will sound better and everything will work better and be more seamless. And it seems when you have problems, it's because you have mismatched product. Have you found that?
Once again, my tools are much better. And so, I can see whether that's the case or not. Generally I'm going to have to say, no, I haven't found that because I have a couple of subwoofers that I recommend that are sort of favorites. I think they're musical, more musical than other subwoofers or have more the ability to integrate to a main system more easily. I think the statement is generally, that would be the case, but there's a problem, and I just ran into this yesterday at a studio, the day before yesterday at the studio, where the subwoofer was sold to these guys as having a crossover, but what it really had was just a low-pass filter. And a lot of subwoofers are sold as they talk about a crossover point, but it's not really a crossover. It's just a low-pass filter on the sub. So your main speakers go out all the way, and then they have to interact, which is much more difficult to have a passive add. It's great when you can do it because you avoid, another piece of electronics. You avoid a crossover, but it doesn't happen all that often that you can get a passive add with a sub in a room and have it really work as well as having a crossover where you can integrate the sub right at the right frequency to interact properly phase-wise with with the main speakers or your satellites or whatever you want to call them. So, yes and no, I'm going to say. Generally, I don't have a problem recommending a variety of subs to people that may not be from the same manufacturer as their main speakers.
What are your favorites then?
Well, I guess favorites.
Or the ones you recommend that you think would work best.
Well, when it comes to main large systems for integration, I'm a Meyer X800 fan. Or the X400, which is because the X800 is a double 18 cabinet. The X400 is a single 18 cabinet. So though for people that need power, they're very fast and very powerful. And they don't suffer as much from, in my, years of history with these things, they don't suffer from needing to be reconed or replaced as much as a lot of the other subs that other manufacturers make. In smaller systems, Dynaudio, the BM series are pretty good and fairly flexible. The Atoms are also musical, not as flexible crossover frequency-wise. But good, good small sub. I think in the medium range, I see a lot of Genelex, and they give you a fair amount of flexibility. Not as much in the crossover as I would like to have, but they're closer to the Atoms where it's a fixed crossover. It's a fixed high pass for the main cabinets, but more flexible. It gives you a frequency range knob for the low pass, which is good. Genelec is just fixed I think the new ones are 85, which is not as flexible. But, I've seen them work very well. I just did last week in L.A. Is a Genelec sub with a PMC main cabinet. And we got lucky. The cabinet, we couldn't move the cabinet at all because of the furniture in the room. But it looked really good. It was a pretty good integration. I was able to use the phase switches and the crossover. I think they give you now a choice between 120 or 85, and I played with that, and you know, I got a really good result. So, you know, my job is, no matter what the gear is, to get the best result I can. You know, yeah, I mean, like I said, I have my favorite, my go-tos, if I'm going to make a recommendation. But I did a fellow's room. He's a composer. He had Meyer HD1, you know, main monitors, yeah. And he had a Blue Sky sub. You know, not on my favorites list, but, you know, I was able to integrate it well, and it sounded good. The client was very happy, and I mean, extremely happy. And the bottom line is, you know,
yeah,
he's making good. He's getting good product out of that room. You know, he's making the right decisions with it. So, you know, I've worked at all different levels. I have some clients that have a gazillion dollars, you know, cost no object, and then I have some clients that are, you know, on a very restricted budget. But, you know, like I said, if you can get them a fairly linear curve that works for them, even if it may be not be top of the line gear, if they could develop a reference, they can, you know, they can do good work with it.
Yeah.
And I've watched some of my clients go from rooms in their condos to big studios, you know, over the years, developing their skills because they can make the proper decisions with their ears, and they develop their skills, and you know, people find out about that, and you know, their careers move forward.
Yeah.
So,
is it more difficult, or is it, how different is it to do like a home theater as opposed to a studio?
Well, a home theater, I mean, if I'm not involved in design, you know, a home theater is really fixed. The only thing you end up being able to do is equalization. You know, the speakers are generally in the wall behind the screen. There's no flexibility for me to go in. You know, I might be able to make some adjustments in the acoustics, but you know, the home theaters that I tune, like I said, if I'm not involved from the ground up with the design, they're a finished product, you know, when I go in there. The speakers are, you can't move the speakers. You can't move the subwoofers or the surrounds. The acoustics are all done. I might make suggestions for changing some of the acoustics, but most people who've paid all this money for a home theater, they're not likely to do any of that. So the only thing they can do is, you know, is equalize the system. So that's, that's really the big difference here. You're just, you know, you're kind of stuck with equalizing home theater.
Yeah. Well, how about the difference between doing a home studio with a commercial studio? And I'm not talking about an elaborate home studio. I'm talking about a typical home studio where you have somebody that's doing some work and doesn't have a whole lot of money. What's happening there? What's the difference?
Well, it's a more difficult job for me, basically, because there's a lot more questions about where the speakers should be. You know, I mean, a commercial studio, generally, somebody's done some design work on it already. You know, or the guy's been in there messing around with acoustics to begin with, you know, I mean, for a number of years before I might get a phone call. So they have, you know, some idea of how to fix some of the problems that they've got. So, that's an easier, you know, job. There's limited amounts of work that needs to go into that, unless the room has just been badly, you know, poorly designed. Then I end up, you know, spending a long time, you know, trying to do it. But your general lower end home studio really has nothing except a pair of speakers in a room. And so you have to start, I mean, one of the first things that I start off by trying to figure out is which walls should the speakers actually be on? You know, because there's another one of these rules of thumb that says, well, you should always have the speakers throw down the length of the room.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily the case. You know, sometimes you'll get a better performance out of the speakers if you put them on the long wall as opposed to the short wall. So I mean, it's just a lot more work, a lot more physical moving of speakers and moving of listening position that goes into that. You know, and once that's established, everything starts to get more straightforward. You know, the first order reflections, like I said, are pretty simple geometry. You know, and then the bass problem. So yeah, you're kind of saying, design a studio in a day is what you're saying to me. Can you design this studio in one day? You know, so it's a bitch. My friends, you know.
Well, speaking of design, do you do much design then?
I'm doing more and more design. And I generally work with architects, you know, when I'm doing the design. But I still, I think one of the things that I learned this puts me at odds with some of the studio designers, or probably most of the studio designers, is that I like to do a shell and then take speakers in and go measure the room and establish speaker positioning, console positioning, and do a mock-up of the acoustics until we get it right, you know, and then, you know, then let them build it, and you wind up walking into it, and it's there already, you know. So as opposed to, you know, a lot of the studio designers just design mostly based on experience and numbers, and
yeah, you have a different approach.
Build the whole thing, and then I get a phone call, you know, saying, you know, I've got this studio that I've just built, but it doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah.
And that's when I go in and, you know, I mean, that's most of the work I get is, can you fix my problem?
Sure.
As opposed to, can you help me not have a problem when I've completed the project? You know, I'm just kind of seen as a fix-it guy more than a design guy.
I remember my first exposure to room tuning was with Coco Brandon, who I'm sure...
Yes.
In the Cherokee days, I used to do a lot of work in Cherokee, and I used to hang out with Coco when he was tuning rooms. I can remember one experience in particular, and he was always big on phase as well. And he went over to the white EQs that they were using, the passive EQs. It was the big thing for them. And there was just one frequency that he barely touched, and the room exploded. It was all of a sudden, it went from okay to wow. And it was one of those times where it's like, oh, I get it. Now I really see what you're doing. Because it was really dramatic. And I'm sure that doesn't happen all the time, but it was interesting to see him work. And of course, they used to tune their rooms, you know, two times a week, three times a week, and change their speakers that often too. It was really crazy. So
that is pretty crazy, actually. But,
I guess my point is...
Lucky Coco. He's making some money.
Well, he was working for them. He was their in-house guy, so he really wasn't. Oh. But he had learned from George Augsburger.
Yes.
But so I guess the question is, what you do has really changed from those days, because they were reliant on those white passive EQs, and before that, I guess they're the Altec ones or the Altec filters that they had,
and Urey, some of the Urey stuff, the old Urey stuff. Well, let me just say this: it hasn't changed. Well, my tool is very different than what Coco and George use. But that technology has changed quite a bit. But Coco still uses, you know, the same tools he used before, because that's, you know, within his comfort zone, and that's that's how he does the work that he's recognized for.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you gave me his tools to use, I'd be screwed. I mean, maybe, well, not screwed because I started off with tools like that. But, you know, but I couldn't, I don't think that I could do the job that I do if I didn't have, if I didn't have the tools that I have. I mean, that's why I went after that, because I felt like I was getting more information that allowed me to do a better job.
Yeah.
Than sticking with the third octave, you know, analysis. But I have a lot of clients that still have the old white passive EQs. And I've got a number of that still have those, the old 4400s. A lot of the studios in LA are still using the white 4700s.
Yeah.
I, like I said, I prefer, and I know I can do a better job because I can see it on my screen. I can tune a room more accurately with the parametric, but I tune a lot of rooms with third octave EQs. Doesn't change my attitude about, you know, the type of job that I do, but I can do a job that's acceptable for a lot of people, you know, using that, you know, using those old EQs. And personally, I like the old passive, the 40, like the 44s, the 4400 series better than the new 41 or 4700 series of whites. This is, you know, my opinion also. The 4700 is a digitally controlled analog, but it only has half dB steps in it. You talk about, you know, minor changes. Sometimes I think a half dB is too much, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to sort of finesse something into place. But, you know, those don't give you as much flexibility as the old ones. And I also think that the old passive EQs sounded better. You know, I think the old 4400s just had a better sound to them than the new ones.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I like tubes and.
Yeah, right. Don't we all?
You know, Yeah. So anyway.
Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that either you learned during your time in the business or someone imparted to you along the way?
Well, I think, you know, Chris Stone taught me, get your money before you release the product. That probably was the best advice he could give me. and it works for a lot of people. You know, I hate to say that, but there became a point in my career where I had to stop billing people. You know, I still bill the majors, you know, but generally, you know, regrettably, people stop paying their bills. It's weird. It's, you know, it has nothing to do with acoustics. But once Chris would say, once they have the tape, they have no incentive to pay the bill.
Yeah.
You know, because they have the tape. But if you're holding the tape, you know, if they want the tape, they have to pay the bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, a very, very astute, which I'm sure, you know, he probably got burned a few times before he realized that was certainly, you know, certainly the case.
Yeah.
Generally I'm pretty steadfast on that. But, as far as studio tuning goes, I think the best advice I could say is don't get locked in to somebody's theory or some rule of thumb, you know, that's gospel. You know, mm-hmm. I'm an agnostic when it comes to, you know, acoustics and room tuning. You know, I'm, you know, prove to me that this is the right way to do it. And if there's a better way to do it, I'm going to find out. You know,
yeah.
I'm going to find that way, and that's what we're going to do. So really, that's the best advice I could do. It's you know, don't get locked. Don't get, you know, tunnel vision about what it is that you're trying to do.
I love it. I love it. Words of wisdom. Thanks so much for being with me today, Bob. This has been great. It's been you know, very enlightening.
Well, listen, I appreciate your giving me a call to do this. I love it. I like educational things. I think it's important. The more educated the engineers can be about this kind of thing, the better our music will become. You know,
absolutely.
I want to keep listening to good sounding tunes.
Don't we all? You can find out more about Bob and his website at bobhodas.com. That's Bob, HODAS, all one word, bobhodas.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyointercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyointercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.